It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey. Wow, they found the tomb of Jesus.
Hey, so what do you think about that?
I don't know. I think it's hilarious.
Are you going to go see it? Buy tickets?
I don't think I can.
No?
It's a Discovery special coming up this weekend.
They don't even have bones in those ossuaries, do they?
That's a fancy term. I always think of a bird in a swamp called an ossuary, but I guess that's an osprey or something. No bones in it, but some interesting descriptions. I mean, all the right
it
names.
Must be them, huh?
I don't know.
He had the kid, right? It's the Da Vinci Code 2. It's leading up to it. I know it is.
There you go. James Cameron decided to take out Christianity in one fell swoop.
Well, he's the author of Titanic, trying to sink another boat.
I guess that boat sinking is addictive. Once you sunk a good boat, you've got
to look for another one. You get paid a near $1 billion to sink a boat, you might as well go for a religion, huh?
Well, Sarah and I had a great talk about it last night. We were just talking about, gosh, what if they find, I mean, what if that really is?
Well, here comes the heretic of the year.
No, it's not that. Yeah, there you go. I thought it was, I mean, it's a fascinating, if those names really correlate to, and there's a 1 in 600 chance that it's, I guess it's not Jesus's and Mary's and Joseph's and whoever, but
and their little boy.
I mean, yeah, if you could prove all that, which the reality is, it's going to be unprovable.
Yeah, you can't.
So, you know, you're not going to prove anything by it. It is intriguing. It does get the world talking again, which is a good thing, I think.
It does cause a whole bunch of consternation for the.
Are you feeling consternated?
I'm not.
No, I'm not.
I'm not. But I've listened to talk radio, and man, some people really get their knickers in a knot. They do.
It's knickers in a twist.
In a twist?
Yeah, that's
okay,
how it,
sorry.
This is for our UK people.
Sorry.
I got corrected once when I was there. That's
okay,
how I know.
Okay, so it's
things.
Not a knot, it's a twist. The knickers in a twist. Well, the reality is. You know, I think for some people, it's like, this is sacred territory. How dare you even question? And the whole idea that you're possibly having a genuine conversation about what if, man, for some folks, that just tilts their deal right now.
Well, I think even Paul, when he talks in 1 Corinthians 15, he said, if there was no resurrection from the dead, then we're of all men most to be pitied. I think, I mean, he had no doubt that Jesus rose from the dead, that we will too at the end of the age. And I don't sit here with any doubts about that, regardless of what they find. But Sarah and I had an interesting conversation last night. We're walking the dogs going, what if they found the bones of Jesus and could thoroughly prove they were his and Jesus never resurrected from the dead? How would that change what Sarah and I would do and what we would believe? And it was a great conversation because on the one hand, we're going, my gosh, God is real and we're enjoying him every day. And that wouldn't stop even if I wouldn't maybe know who I'm relating to then, but I'm sure loving it. So
it's Nemo.
Nemo. I'm getting fish vibes from the sea. But, you know, on the other hand, Paul says if it's not true, then we should just go eat, drink, and tomorrow we die and there is no resurrection. So you might as well indulge the crud out of yourself. And that's another way to look at it. But I think the conversation is fascinating. I don't think people need to be afraid of it. My gosh, if the more certain you are of something, the less you're afraid of talking about it.
Well, if you have a genuine relationship, an actual friendship with Jesus right now, I don't find those things terrifying. Because you're just going like, look, I'm relating to a person.
Yeah,
okay. But you might then go like, gosh, now doctrinally, some of my T's are now tilted and I'm not sure what to do. I don't know how to eye everything. But when you look at those dynamics, it's like, wait a minute. I have a relationship with God and nobody's going to be able to take that. That is not a fabrication for me. I don't end up going like, gee, I wonder if I really do
but
or not.
But that's what other people would say. Other people would say, well, it's your little invisible friend you could never lost from kindergarten, you know?
Well,
that's what some people
for me,
would
say. I did meet him in kindergarten, and I've had him ever since.
There you
since.
Go.
So
people
for me,
say,
it works.
Some
it's
people
consistent.
Say you're ready to be committed. That's exactly
some
right.
Some people have thought that for a long time. But,
yeah.
But so for me, it's not terribly terrifying. I think for other folks, when when your faith has, I mean, and Paul talked about this, is look, I want you to not have your faith resting on the mere words of men's wisdom. I didn't come in persuasive, you know, speech, but I came rather in power and demonstration of the power of God. And you're just going like, why? Well, so that your faith is based in an experienced reality that is unshakable, and here's that person. That's who Paul met. And so it's like, for him, it's like, I don't question this. But if it's just doctrine that you've been related to, and it's just principles, man, this is very threatening to that.
Well, I can see it coming on the forum now. There are people who really wrestle with the fact that I don't know that I've ever had that engagement with the reality. So for me, it is. I've accepted the truth of Scripture. I'm trying to walk in those principles as best I know how. I'm hoping God makes himself known to me someday, but it hasn't happened yet. What do you say to them?
I would say don't stop. I would say God actually wants to become, I mean, all you got to do is read some of what Paul wrote, and he's talking about, you know, a palpable reality. You know, it's like the other gospel writers are saying, like, these things we felt with our hands, we touched, and it's like, these we write to you.
But they're talking about the physical Jesus there, aren't they? That's how I've understood that.
Yeah, but as I relate to that, they're exhorting us unto that reality. I don't think they had in their mind, you know what, we hung out with him, but he's not real now. That is not at all in their concept.
But when they're talking about it being that tangible, feeling, tasting, seeing, they're really talking about the physical presence. But they go on, to make clear, it's no less real now.
I think that's the dynamic that I'm coming at. It's like, you know what, the tenor of Scripture sets that up as a very reasonable expectation for someone to say, you know what, as I'm seeking to have a relationship with him, that's not just for the holy few, that's for the many and all. That's part of the reality of this. And while you may be struggling in the hallway of, I can't pinpoint that for me yet, the reality is God wants to invade the whole of your life, and he wants to become that real and that tangible. And so while I don't think it's a performance thing, and I don't think it's a light switch you can just flick, the reality is I think it's a genuine expectation that you can confidently open up to and say, hey, God,
should we say expectancy?
Expectancy, yes.
Okay, yeah, that's so.
But in that whole dynamic, I think for a lot of people, if it isn't something that can be an active expectancy, if it's something that's not within my framework to go like, well, no, you know, I don't think so, I do think that limits you to be able to enter into that. I think that's a barrier.
No, I do, and I just my heart goes out to people that say, I don't know that I've ever been able to identify a way God has made himself known to me as an individual. So my whole life is lived through the Scriptures and through principles and through teachings. And I agree with you. You just got to keep sorting that out with him, asking him, getting help from a mature brother or sister that might be able to help you see through some of that.
And perhaps peeling off some of the spectacularness of how that's understood or interpreted. I sort of feel like, you know what?
That's the point I was getting to with expectations, really different than an expectancy of how God might do something.
Yeah, I think sometimes we can have expectations of what that looks like, and those can be perhaps inappropriate and simply shifted to the spectacular realm. I think God appears in the mundane, and I think he's ever present in some of those things, and he can be readily seen. But I think some people are like, well, that's just too usual, and you're just going like, well, he's that real, he's that present.
So are you gonna watch the special?
Yeah, if I'm not down in Orange County putting in some hours.
Well, I'm not gonna be able to watch it till I get home. I'm going to Nashville, and then I'll be Sunday night I'll be hanging out with the ACLU and some other education folks dealing with evolution, intelligent design issues. So I'll actually be – the one thing I don't like is when believers react to this kind of James Cameron special kind of thing as, this is the conspiracy to undermine Christianity again. Because I think there are people who – you find an interesting thing and they're trying to verify as much as they can. They can't prove what it is or isn't.
But what a profound conversation starter.
It's a great way to talk, and I don't think people need to be afraid of it. I hope people do watch it, and I hope people get a sense of –
Thing that does intrigue me about this, and, you know, I think some people from a religious construct look at this and go like, ooh, enemy and terrible, you know, heresy. But I look at the fascination with the humanity of Jesus. I think that the church has so emphasized his deity as an issue of doctrine that we have not equally embraced, that is there for us to embrace and to really enjoy, is the actual humanity that God, very God, took upon him, humanity. And we have someone that is that familiar with the life you and I live.
Absolutely. And they might have built him an ossuary, and he just never needed it because he got out before he got ripped.
What about his kid, though, huh?
I don't think the kid's going to work.
That one seems to be a little bit out there.
Well, it's not that Yeshua was not an uncommon name in that time, so it could be some Judah that belongs to some Yeshua. I have a hard time thinking Jesus would call his kid Judas, too.
Jesus, Jesus is Latin. Well, it might speak of some kind of like healing that happened relationally.
Oh, there you go. Wow, we got a lot of email from the Shame Podcast and a lot of activity on the forum, which has been interesting. I got said to one blog that, and I put this on my Livestream blog if you want the link to this, but it's a blog called Live with Desire. This gal, I'm not even sure what her name is. It's not on the top of her blog here, but she said, I listened today to a podcast over at the God Journey called The Shame Game. FYI, the podcasts are very worth listening to. They're conversations between two friends, but you have to sit through a few minutes of inane stuff at the beginning. But once they start talking, wowzer, have a pen and paper handy because they're going to be things you want to write down.
We got a wowzer?
No, wowzer.
Wow.
But her article on this is just a wonderful way that God worked in her through that podcast, seeing how much shame was an overlay of her life and how much God wanted to set her free. It's a great testimony of what God's done in her, so... Folks might want to check that out, the link from the Livestream blog, if you want to get over there and check it out from there.
And then we had some of the discussion on the forum. You got something that Corey asked a question
on. We do,
on.
But before we get to that, just a few other comments from people I thought was a lot of fun. Sue from Aussieland, said, just in the midst of the latest TJ podcast on shame, and she said, honestly, you guys can just go on talking about this till all the world's cows come home if you want. This and the cross. I think we are all so starved for this, even those of us who have started on the journey toward living in the cross, that there are just hours and hours of discussion and letting it sink in our freedom, talking about our freedom from shame. And then we've got another one here from Marianne. She said, thanks so much for your podcast on shame. I'm beginning to see how much of my life was being driven by shame. I was raised in a shame-based religion, then at 20 found Christ. For a few glorious months, I found freedom and love as I read the Bible from cover to cover and sensed God's great mercy and love for me. And then I got involved in a campus group, and the shame game started all over again. Finally, at age 48, I extricated myself from that fellowship. I've returned to the wonder of just knowing God and allowing myself to feel accepted by Him just as I am. What a letter. Gosh, so nice to be able to relax and just be myself and rely on the Spirit to lovingly guide me. Instead of that wagging finger from the pulpit. Whoa, that wagging finger.
It's interesting. The other night I read a story to Taylor by Max Lucado.
Taylor's your daughter?
Taylor's my daughter. Mm-hmm. And I was putting her to bed, and I didn't preface the story. I knew it was written by Max Lucado, so I knew it was some kind of like, you know, unveiling of God's heart and stuff like that. And it was called Just the Way You Are. And the little parable was that these five little orphans were adopted by a king. And the king was going to come visit them and bring them to the castle. And they didn't know what to do. And they're all excited. And the adults told them, well, you got to have to prepare a gift for the king. And so four of the kids all had exceptional talents in something or another. And so they went off trying to accomplish all of this. And they got really busy in their gift making and their talent achieving and all that stuff. And there was this one little girl that didn't have many talent. She didn't think she had any talent at all, but she had a kind heart. And you looked at all of this when the king actually showed up, and he didn't come as in the triumphal procession. He just came as a guy through the gate. The little girl just loved him and cared for him as she did everybody. And all the others were too busy trying to prepare their thing for the king that they didn't even recognize him in their midst. And, you know, I'm reading this to Taylor, and Taylor hasn't been, you know, she hasn't grown up in this fear-based, you know, performance dynamic, so she's not really, and I said, who do you think the king is? She looked at me, and she's like, well, he's the king. And, I mean, she had no idea. She wasn't trying to, she wasn't
in, with Jesus, huh?
Yeah, she wasn't in a religious construct. And I just said, you know what? I said, I think this is a lot like God our Father. And it's like the little light came on. And she says, he's with me all the time. I mean, it was a wonderful little moment of Marvel.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, King's not coming.
And how I saw, and just her little heart, she wasn't on the performance treadmill. And I sat there and I went, what would life be like if she never steps on this thing? It'll be extraordinary to watch.
Wait till you start bugging her about bringing A's home instead of D's.
Yeah.
Hopefully not.
You'll love this from Sandy in Pennsylvania. She starts out her note.
Well, that was very good. Turn your podcast down.
She said, picture me screaming for joy. I have finally found some brothers who get it, get me, get what I've been feeling, experiencing, contemplating for the last number of years in my journey with Jesus. I've been listening to your archived podcast for the past 6 months after an extremely painful departure from a lifelong congregation, which became very performance-based and authoritarian upon the arrival of a new pastor. I stumbled onto your website when looking for some kind of affirmation that what I perceived was happening within me, within the church, was not of God but of man, and oh my goodness, have I felt like a pig in a feeding trough. Someone else wrote me last week about Livestream, said they felt like I got in the Livestream website for the first time and plowed through some of the articles and said I felt like a mosquito in a nudist colony.
Oh, there you go.
Well, the metaphors just keep on rolling.
There you go.
But, interesting emails. Happy to be part of that. In fact, I spent the weekend with a group of folks up in the Sierras talking through the cross, talk about some of the shame issues and finding freedom from those kinds of things and the law and what it was meant to do, but what it couldn't accomplish in transforming us, and that conformity is not the process God uses, but transformation. It's wonderful times. When I got done on Sunday morning, I sat down next to one of the guys that's, I think, an elder among this group, or at least one of the folks that has some time with them and experience. And he sat down next to me and he just leaned over and said, you know what I heard you saying about the law? I said, no. He said, I think I have a new definition for the law. And I said, what's that? He said, the law is how you're supposed to treat people you don't love. And I thought about that for a minute. I went, man, if we just, what a definition for the, because as Paul says, love fulfills the whole law. So if you get the loving thing down, you don't need law because you'll go far beyond what the law says. But if you don't love God, then the law will tell you how you should treat him. And if you don't love yourself enough to walk in God's holiness and instead want to live to your own indulgence, then the law might be a good place where you to go if you don't love yourself. And if you don't know how to treat people around you with kindness and respect, then love will teach you how, the law will teach you how to treat others. I thought what a great,
that's a little mind blowing.
I thought it was, what a wonderful twist on the law, because now it says it really, really the law is a cheap substitute. Learning to love like God loves, be loved by him and love him in return. You know what? That just goes way beyond what the law would ever be able to ask you to do or demand you to do. And I love
it. But it also frames the law, and it also frames it with the heart that's there. I do think it's like, you know what? When people look at the law and they go, oh, wonderful, I think there is something of the beauty in it. We are to care for each other, but it's not out of obligation.
That's right.
And when you don't, when you're not first touched by love, I mean, we love because he first loved us. If that kiss hasn't happened, if that hasn't released something in you, and you're just trying to guts it out, well, you know, good luck, because it's pretty darn hard loving people. I got one of these emails, that, you know, little letters from God, and this from this little girl. God, I bet it's hard for you to love everybody, everywhere, all over the whole world. I bet that's really hard because I only have 4 people in my family and I can't do it. and just the innocence of that, where it's like, yeah. You know what? The reality is if that is not empowering this life, this thing is hard.
Well, the law says is it's impossible.
Yeah.
Obligation will not get you there.
Right.
If it's not in your heart and a transformed heart by the Lord, then you're kind of caught up in this, dare we say, narcissistic this week, since...
this new study came out on that thing.
New study. We'll get to Corey's question still in a moment, because I think it's a great question. Maybe we want to end there. But the college students, this new report came out, yesterday's paper. It's been all over media here in the States. Some kind of study. I'm trying to find the name of it here. It was out of the University of Georgia. It's called Generation Me, Why Today's Young Americans Are More Confident, Assertive, Entitled, and More Miserable Than Ever.
Ooh.
And it kind of, some people think this is kind of attack against a generation. When I just read through this, I said, well, you guys finally discovered sin. I mean, all their surveys, they finally said this whole self-preferring, my universe revolves around me, I get to have whatever I want. Being famous is the only value anymore. Be a celebrity somehow. YouTube, American Idol, Australian Idol, UK Idol, whatever.
And the desire to be rich is thrown in there.
And they're saying that's even second to just wanting to be famous. People just want to be famous. They feel like they're special. They agree with statements like, this has statements on it, like, if I ruled the world, it would be a better place. Now, how many people do you know that to be true of? I think most of us could probably do better than some of the rulers we have now, but that's beside the point.
I'm pretty sure most people would recognize, gee, I don't want that job.
But the inventory, the survey that they did, more people in the generation now in college agreed with these statements. If I ruled the world, it would be a better place. I think I am a special person, and I can live my life any way I want to. And yet they're saying, here's the other side of that, more self-possessed maybe than, and I look at this, and I know a lot of adults who think this way, so this is not a slam on college kids from me, because I think what they're identifying, this is just the way sin works in us. I want to be in charge. I'm more special than the rest of you, so I can get exceptions to everything.
Mine.
Yeah, the old seagulls and Nemo again. I thought this was funny. So unfortunately, narcissism can also have very negative consequences for society, including the breakdown of close relationships with others. One guy said, from the University of Washington, Hannity Kadar said this, I can see goals and ambitions getting in the way of other things, like relationships.
No kidding. Wow. Well, at least there's a survey that kind of gets to the point.
Oh, man, does that not hit it? That whole self-preferring, self-actualizing, every little thing I do is important enough to be put on a YouTube video. Or
do they get into postulating why that has occurred or why that is more unique to this generation than others?
They actually source it to the self-esteem programs that have been in schools for the last 20 years. Of, I guess they sing Frère Jacques, that old song, instead of singing it, you know, Brother John, they think, I am special, look at me. So, you know, the whole self-esteem.
Mirror, mirror on the wall, I am the fairest of them all.
There you go. You don't need the mirror anymore.
Yeah, it's like, look at me.
No, there has been a concerted effort to feel like low self-esteem has been an issue, so in pumping people up.
Well, anyone with little kids realizes that there is a value and a need for kids to have a good sense of self-esteem.
Absolutely.
But a self-obsession or an absorption or a conceit and arrogance and a pride with that, no, that's not so hot.
Or that no matter what we do, everybody gets a blue ribbon at the end of the day because you're all first place and you're all special. I mean, there's just ways that we've really...
Yeah, we have... Well, what's so frustrating for me is the whole notion of self-sacrifice and the serving of one another. I mean, I love the fact, and this is not a little promo for how wonderful my kids are, but somehow my kids have embraced the care for others. And for them, it's kind of natural. But for a lot of the friends they have, it is not natural at all. And they come home with a confused, perplexed, going like, I don't get this. How come this is natural to my thinking and it's totally absent from theirs? And I'm going like, well, check their parents. You know, I mean, because, but there has been a progressive passing on and perhaps a loss of the value of caring for others.
And I know also there's surveys out that have said, the generation now, high school people going into college, there's a lot more community service components that are a part of the high school framework and college. And so, you know, it's unfair to tag this generation because I think there are some very selfless people who don't even know Christ yet and have just grown up with an expanded sense of why they're on the planet and caring for others and doing that great personal risk. But I do think what this highlights so well to me is how being stuck on me, actually, particularly for people who that we're talking to on this podcast, who have a heart for spiritual growth and spiritual life, even if I'm focused on me and my spiritual life, and the more I focus on me, the less healthy relationships I'm going to have with other people.
Yeah,
it isn't all about you.
You seek to save your life, and you will lose it.
And I think that flesh, the way I defined it this weekend, talking with the group I was at, and I think this is really true of our self-preferring nature, what sin is at its root, not just sins that we do wrong, but sin at its root really is, what, no matter what circumstance I'm in, I'm trying to either maximize my benefit, how can I get the best out of this for me, or how do I minimize whatever pain might be in here for me? And a lot of our defense mechanisms in relationships are about, I'll reject you before you can reject me. It's all about, how do I maximize my benefit? How do I minimize my pain? We're dominated by that. I was outside of Christ. I think, I don't know how people get beyond that outside of that. I think when you figure out and sort out how loved you are by Him and how your life takes on a whole different meaning, that, gosh, it isn't about me. It isn't about my benefit. It isn't about protecting me even from bad things that could happen, but living in the world as a responsive person to the life of Jesus.
See, I think that's where a little bit of shame and self are connected, is when you look at that, you know, that sense that I'm too self-conscious. Oh, I'm outside of the love and favor of God, as if you could be, you know? But when you're aware of that, then you go into circle the wagons, kind of how to protect myself, and you start to have an overabsorbed focus on me and what I need to do. And it's like, you know what? I don't really see how you can live this Christian life with that as a central pillar that's still there. And until that gets toppled, where it's like, it's not like, gee, what a worm I am and I'm worthless. It's more like, I'm just not the center of the universe. I am not the single focus of what's going on. Decisions are not made always in relationship to me and what it works for me.
Yeah, and everybody's actions toward me are not necessarily personal. They've got other things going on. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, when people get so overboarded and dramatic about them, you sit there and it's like, you know what? You might be feeling bad, but guess what? Having known a whole bunch of people, the reality is they're really not thinking about you as much as you're afraid.
Yeah, true.
I mean, the truth is, they just aren't. More people I know at the end of the day are more thinking through their own little lens, looking at their life. And the people that are such a breath of fresh air are the ones that don't seem to be so concerned about themselves.
Yeah.
They're the ones that are, you kind of enjoy being with them. And it's not because they're shining all their light on you. It's more
right.
Because it's not an issue.
Right. And they're free enough to ask and discover, and their life is not all wrapped up in what they're doing, what they're discovering, what they're struggling with. And I think part of that, what that study kind of indicates, is the more narcissistic we live, and that's a pretty big term. I think I've only known one true narcissist in my whole life, maybe two. And they're incredibly destructive people to be around. It really is. You may have. I look back and say, this whole idea of being self-centered and self-focused and just trying to survive and get benefits and do what I can do for myself, it's also very self-fulfilling in terms of the relationships it destroys.
Oh, yeah.
Only feeds that sense of worthlessness and shame. And so they try harder to be the center of attention, which, again, causes
only
other people to
alienates it.
Yeah, because I don't want to. People don't want to be near that.
No,
but I do think what Jesus, whether it was Zacchaeus, woman at the well, people in shame, or you know, Zacchaeus is just, hey, my world, I'll rip everybody off in town I can. He was able to crawl into that kind of person and give them a whole other way to live. And I do think as we learn to love better, I think even then our relationships aren't, well, that person's easy to be with and fun to be with, so I'm going to hang out with them. Part of that happens naturally. I think that's great. There's also saying that person acts like a total idiot because they've never known what love is, and they're trying to get it from everybody.
You think of when God steps into a life and overwhelms them with the reality that they are loved. Man, that I think that and perhaps that alone conquers that narcissism or that bent towards it. Because when all of a sudden that's real and received, and someone starts to feel that inside, we're just going, like, you know what? You can exhort them all you want how to not be selfish, how to stop trying to defend for them. You know, and it's like, but the reality is those exhortations are impotent to do anything as far as change. But when that person knows and feels and the reality of being loved touches that, it's like that little pillar just falls over.
Yeah.
And that's why it's like, you know, the whole importance of being able to go, God, the simplicity of you love me. And then what releases back is I love you. To trip past that, think that there's something more important. You know, it's like we've got to really get back to that, because when that doesn't start the whole thing, nothing else works.
Yeah, and that's kind of like the bomb that gets exploded that changes everything else. If sin is really the lack or the absence of love, and it really is living in the absence of God's love for me and a real sense of healthy love for myself, then that explosion is there's no place in our life where that doesn't eventually have ramifications over time. Love really does change us. It really does rewrite how I respond to people, how I respond to situations, how I respond to God.
Well, you know, I want to bring in Corey's little question, and I'm just going to paraphrase it. But
well, let me read it to you. I think he really asked a pretty provocative question that other people think, well, he said, so he's talking about the commands, and Jesus gave his command. He says, is anyone else trying to figure out the relationship of shame and guilt to obedience to Christ? And then talks about some of the commands. So if I'm not keeping his commands, then shouldn't I feel some guilt? It seems that feeling bad for not honoring my Lord is appropriate. I can see how shame could come into play when another human makes me look and feel bad for the same thing. That kind of shaming others is gross. So what is the distinction between shame and legitimate guilt?
Well, I think where there is sin and where there is a conscience that functions, there is going to be such a thing as guilt. I think it's going to be there. But I want to turn this around. Does God want me to feel shame? Does he want me to feel guilt? Religious experts all my life have said, well, yes.
The wagging finger from the pulpit.
Like, it's a, of course, because where there's real wrong, you should feel those. And it's like they can't say the statement without doing the action. And yet you read like where Paul's talking about, you know, for those who are in Christ, there is therefore now no condemnation. None whatsoever. It's gone. You sit there, it's like,
would you put shame, guilt, and condemnation into the same application?
You can perhaps parse them out into their little differences, but in terms of what happens to us, I think they're all part of the same dynamic of what we end up feeling. It's that bad smell in the room. It's the, And I think most people, it's like, that's the ocean that they live in. They're little fish, and their entire environment is permeated with some variation on shame and guilt. And those have been the biggest motivators to try to get people to behave. And you're just going, like, I think Christ's entrance is to try to take us out of that. And it really is like a fish who swims in water being liberated into air. And you're just going, like, oh, how can that be? It's like, no, it really is
And you hope the lungs are developed.
Yeah, it really is that transformational, because you go like, oh, well, then the fish is going to die. Well, yes, the analogy actually works. There is a part of me that is totally going to die. And it is that sin nature, that self-absorbed focus, the tendency towards narcissism, that gets killed in that transformation. And then there's a whole different way to live.
So the question is, their legitimate guilt is kind of a funny one, because I wouldn't say, how are we going to parse out which is legitimate and what is not? I would say that outside of Christ, guilt is a reality.
Yeah.
So it's not legitimate.
Unavoidable.
Or illegitimate. It's just a
reality. You're going to feel it.
I think shame, like we said, shame and sin are two different sides of the same coin, the same reality. They produce sin and shame in us and the condemnation that results from that. So if we get turned on to Christ, however, then shame is displaced in us so that I can come to God at my most broken and where I'm hurting and let God adjust things. And I think it gets
shattered and crucified with Christ.
Maybe the question
on the
is,
cross.
Does God see any legitimate need for guilt? And I think what we see in the life of Christ and we see in the cross is guilt's not serving him. Guilt's not bringing people to him. Guilt is driving people away from the very God who loves them and can rearrange their lives. So the point is, no, God's done everything he could to free us from sin and guilt, which doesn't mean, I've done something that's hurt Sarah. I've done something that's, you know, I know wasn't God's best for me in a situation. Do I have some remorse about that and some sorrow? And gosh, I'm sorry that happened. Absolutely. To me, that's not the guilt and shame that crams you in this little rotten little worm box that we tend to crawl into. I think it just says, well, I blew it. Make apologies to people that it impacted. and look for ways to move on in a more healthy way. But to me, that's not the guilt and condemnation that drives us away from God. That's just the honesty of saying, hey, there's wonderful things God's done in my life. There's still broken places we're working on. And I'm sorry where they impact you.
Yeah, and what we're not talking about is the birth of a sociopath. We're not saying, gee, remove all guilt and shame and all sense of right and wrong. And not at all.
No, absolutely
okay?
not.
But I do think that God's love is meant to be that transformational. I really do. I think the power of the cross, what was transacted there, is meant to put all the religious manipulators that have so, you know, been foisted on people, it's destroying those. Those are not, God is not trying to guilt me into obeying him. And he's not trying to go like, when I mess up, I don't think God comes down and go like, I want you to feel awful. And then you'll do right.
Then you'll be better.
Yeah. I mean, cause you know what? It doesn't work.
I already feel bad enough about myself to start with. I don't need God piling that one on. You know, that's the reality.
And I think that, you know, where there is a focus on the rules or the need for rule keeping, this is going to sound like a completely unknown foreign language to somebody. It's just going to be like, what are they talking about? I don't get this. Because it is like the water that the fish swims in. How can you remove guilt and shame? Those are so effective at manipulating behavior.
Oh, and I had the question.
And without that, how do you get someone to conform?
And I had that question this weekend because somebody said, well, if I don't have shame and guilt, what else do I do? I wouldn't do anything for God. And you're going, okay, that's a big statement. Parse that out. Here's somebody that hasn't, because I think that's exactly right. And what we do know about guilt and shame, can some of us, in the fear of being humiliated, do right behaviors? Does it work in a temporal sense? We'd all say yes, absolutely
yes.
It works. But in the long run, what God says is it doesn't work. You're only good as long as you're afraid. You're only good as long as you fear the humiliation, the shame, what other people might find out about you. And in the long run, it's not going to change you. It's going to drive those behaviors down into other kinds of unhealthy activities.
Well, it's like trying to conquer one disease by giving you another. It's like, you know what? Maybe it corrects something for a moment, but the truth is then you're worse off in a different condition that you're just as stuck from.
Yeah, I'm going through the withdrawals of cocaine. So you know what will help you? More cocaine. And for the moment, I guess, I've never had it, but I guess it helps for a couple hours. And then you right back. And I think that's a great analogy for what guilt does and what shame does. It feeds the same disease.
See, you think of Romans 12:1 where it says, you know, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. In the context is no longer be conformed into the image of this world. Well, how about you add to the image of the religious world?
Well, sure.
Yeah. The whole idea of conforming something, forcing it, stuffing it into this box of expectations.
This is why we get hate mail, you know.
Yeah, I know. But I don't think that God is asking for that. I think he's trying to say, I'd like something completely other to happen here. I don't want you forcing. I want to bring about a change. I'm not looking for conforming to a standard as if the standard were more important to the thing I'm conforming.
Right.
I want a change and a transformation. What you can't do, I can. So I'd like to come in and rework everything so that what wasn't possible is possible because it's fueled by something that works. Law can't achieve what love does. Only love and the entrance of it can. And love will fulfill everything.
And if there's any conclusion of the New Testament, I think it is that. It is love is the most powerful force in the universe. It's stronger than fear. It's stronger than shame. It's stronger than guilt. It's stronger than anything else to get people to change. But the religious world has, for the last 2,000 years and longer, and go back even to other false religious type things, fear and shame and guilt is the only motivators it tries to use, even to get people to pretend that they love, which is just, in God's eyes, so bizarre as to be ridiculous.
Well, they're so universally present. I mean, that's like, I don't want to say that shame doesn't exist. It is
it
is universally present.
But do we exploit it?
That's the issue. I think system structures in religions, they go like, you know what? This is right there. I'm going to use this towards this supposed good end. And you're just going like, I don't think that's a good end. I think that is that cheap substitute. Okay, conform someone to the rules. But if you don't end up changing the heart, what have you done? You haven't done anything.
And you need ever-increasing doses of guilt to keep to that level of performance.
Yeah, and ultimately, guess what? It will fail, and you will fall off. And that's when we go like, oh, now everyone can shake their finger at a Ted Haggard. And you're just going like, guess what? I don't think Ted is any different. I don't have any need to throw a rock at Ted.
Yep.
Because I don't see how that is any different than the treadmill that most everybody I know still is running on. In terms of they're just trying to keep those urges, those things that they know they don't want, they're just trying to keep them at bay somehow.
And you might repress it for a long time in guilt and shame, but when it explodes, it really explodes.
Yeah.
And that's why God just wants to keep loving us into the fullness of his life. And part of that, Jesus said very clear, part of that process is I need to move you from shame into love and acceptance. Then I can get the transforming work done.
And for some people, when it's so confusing, it's like part of me is like, yeah, I understand that. I totally get that. It's not going to make sense by anything that I say, but as that reality comes in, then it's like someone who is blind and you ask them to, you know, please tell me what red is. I'm sorry. If they've never seen before, there's nothing to say. They have no concept, no frame of reference. But as soon as sight comes in, wow, there is a whole new universe with which to sort of relate to. And for folks that, what would you say to someone who's going like, okay, I'm stuck in shame, but the love you're talking about is foreign to me? What do you say to them?
Well, I think the New Testament says it's the teaching of the cross. It's the proclamation and revelation of the cross that resolves our shame. It's not just, hey, pretend you don't have any. Try and live without shame. This is not mental gymnastics. The reality is it's the cross of Jesus Christ that has removed our shame. If you don't know that, there's something about the cross you have yet to understand. And that might be where you'd pray, might be where you'd look, might be where you do a little reading, a little listening. And find out exactly how God changed it. I think, like Sue said, this is a conversation we need to have over and over again. Shame has been so reinforced in our religious world that we swim in it like we're supposed to be there, instead of taking the liberty that Christ has given us.
Thanks for traveling with us today on The God Journey. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd appreciate your comments or your questions by email or at our website, thegodjourney.com. Stop by today and join the conversation.